I'm Judy Pearson. I'm a very grateful alcoholic.
Hi, Judy.
Good to be here. I want to thank the committee for asking me here. It's always amazing to me that I get to come to these things and I get to be treated so well. And so lovingly, you know, and with so much respect. And I still, a lot of times, I can't figure out why. You know, I just can't figure out why. Alcoholics Anonymous as a program is miraculous to me. It's just a miracle. And it's not just a miracle in my life. I think it's a miracle in everyone's life in this room. To me, it's a miracle that any alcoholic can go 1 hour without a drink. And if you're the kind of alcoholic I was, that was amazing. That was just amazing. I have been spoiled this weekend. And, you know, sometimes when I do this, the committee will pick you up at the airport and they'll take you to the hotel and they'll drop you off and they'll give you your room key and they'll say, have a nice weekend. And that's it. And that's the last you ever see anybody. And you feel kind of abandoned, you know. And that's not been the case here, and I'm very grateful for that. Rosie came and picked me up at the airport. And when I go to one of these things, I don't pack lightly, okay? I am going to be comfortable. So my suitcase will go about 75 pounds. But see, I don't have to worry about it, because I know there's some poor drunk that's got to tote that thing, because a committee sent him, you know? No problem. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like today. That's the quote from How It Works. The quote is not what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. It talks about us. It brings it right back to us. I don't change a whole lot of that. I stick to that format. That's best for me because I have a tendency to get confused real easily. And if I keep that in mind before I get up to share, I know exactly what my purpose is up here and what I'm supposed to be doing. You see, you may not have lived the way that I lived during my act of alcoholism, okay? You may not have done the things that I did, but you'll know what I felt, and I'll talk a lot about what I felt and what I felt about myself and what I felt about the people around me and what I felt about the world in general. And you'll be able to identify there, and that's our common bond. Now, we all have different stories because we're individuals. But the unique thing about this glorious program is that we all felt the same. And I had a lady in Alcoholics Anonymous tell me one time that I got to Alcoholics Anonymous because of the way I was feeling, not because of the way I was thinking. And I stay in Alcoholics Anonymous for the same reason I stayed with booze, because it makes me feel good. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous makes me feel good. Alcoholics Anonymous gives me a purpose. Gives me a purpose. When I first started doing this, I had a lady come up to me one time after I talked, and she said, Judy, I enjoyed your talk very much, and really appreciated what you had to say. However, could you clean it up a little bit? And being that I was trying to be open-minded and spiritual, I looked at that a little, you know, and I looked at my story, and I thought, okay, what could I clean up? And I kept looking, and I kept looking, and I came to the conclusion that if I cleaned up my story, I would not have a story, okay? It would disappear, because there's nothing clean, there's nothing pretty, and there's not much that's fun about my story. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous gives us answers when we seek them. And I started seeking an answer in the Big Book, and I found one. And I've started reading this recently. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women, desperately in need, will see these pages. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. You see? So I don't clean it up anymore. And I'm grateful that the Big Book gave me my answer. I took my first drink at the age of 10. I came from a Polish Catholic home. That would pretty well explain the whole deal right there, wouldn't it? It just, you know, I kind of feel like I was doomed from the onset, you know. The thing that I have to remember about that very first drink was that I loved it. And that's important for me to remember, you see, because most 10-year-old children don't love alcohol. You know. But I loved everything about it. I loved the way it tastes. I loved the way it went down. And my God, I loved what it did when it got there. You know, that place wherever there is. But when it got there and everything just kind of set itself free. And it got me to where I wanted to be. By the time I was 12, I was still on liquor. From my stepfather's liquor cabinet. And by the time I was 14, I was an alcoholic, as I know an alcoholic to be today. The only thing that I see in my childhood that is even worthy of noting as a small child was I stuttered horribly. And as a result of stuttering horribly and not being able to communicate with people, I read a lot. And I enjoyed reading. And I would get into the Grimm's fairy tales and I'd read for hours. And I just loved to read. And I loved going off somewhere in my mind in that fantasy land. You know, and that's nothing that's unnatural for a child. Children are supposed to fantasize. And I just loved it. And I stayed in the books and the endings. You know, where the knight in shining armor came and got the princess. And all was well. And they lived happily ever after. And that was to set a pattern in my life because I kept looking for that prince. You know, that knight in shining armor that would take me away and I would live happily ever after. And I knew that's what was going to happen for me. That's what I wanted. My mother divorced when I was 5 or 6, and she was to remarry about a year later. And unbeknownst to us or her, I had a kid sister at the time, and unbeknownst to us or her, she married an alcoholic in the early stages of alcoholism. And this is the part of my story where I relate so much to the Al-Anons in this program, you see, because I remember what my stepfather was like when my mother married him. You know? And he was a kind and giving and loving man with a fantastic sense of humor. Just a fantastic sense of humor. He was a brilliant man. Just brilliant. And he was filled with a lot of love and caring for people in general. You know? And God, he was just wonderful. He was just wonderful. And I can remember as a child when the drinking progressed, I became so confused because this man who I absolutely adored became mean and cruel and violent. You know? And it all changed and I could never understand what happened. And God, how I wanted it to go back to like it used to be. I wanted that so desperately. You know? As his alcoholism progressed, violence became a way of life in our home. You know, it was nothing uncommon for me to get beat up. That's just the way it was for me. I'm one of those kids that came from an alcoholic home that was physically abused and I was sexually abused. And that's just the way it was for me. That's the cards that were dealt me. Okay. Now, I'm going to interject here that Alcoholics Anonymous has fixed that, too. All right. All the bad feelings, all the hatred I had for that man, the impulses I had to kill him have gone. Okay. And that is as a direct result of working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That is as a direct result of listening to the advice of those, they're termed suggestions now, but the people that worked with me in this program didn't suggest a thing. I'll tell you, they didn't do it, you know. Okay. And it was through that that I was able to forgive. It was through that that I was able to at least understand. Not to dismiss it, you know, but to be more compassionate, more understanding. And more forgiving. The program can do that for you too if you happen to come from where I come from. As I said, by the time I was 14, I was alcoholic and I was going to high school, of course, and I was doing the best I could and I got through high school and there's a lot that went on there, but none of it really important. And I got out in the world and I started working before I left high school and I started drawing those checks and I made the decision after I got the first full paycheck that I'm not going to college. No, I didn't go. That's the first decision in my life I made that was solely on alcohol. Now, let me tell you why I made that decision. I knew that if I got into college, there would be some matron guarding the dorm who was always watching. And I knew that if I went to college, I couldn't drink. Now, I don't know where I got that, because University of Georgia, that's all they do. I don't think they go to, you know. But I just somehow had in my mind it would interfere with my drinking, and I didn't want to go. And then I had the paycheck, so I thought, fine. and I did the things that young women are supposed to do. I had a nice little decent job, and this is real crucial. It's real important that you know that, you see, my family, we lived on the best side of Atlanta. Of course, we had to. You have to keep the image up, you know that. You know, and my stepfather worked for one of the largest firms in this country, and he had a nice long title that was very, very impressive. You know, and I went to the right high school, you know. I did all those outside things that were correct and proper and decent. And so when I got a job, I got a correct and proper and decent job. And I went to work for one of the largest department stores in Atlanta. And I was 17 when I graduated from high school and went to work for this department store. And as most alcoholics do, I fell upstairs. And inside of 2 years, I was managing a department at that store. And I had 40 women working under me that were 2 and 3 times my age. I was 19 years old, and I was the youngest head of sales at that store. But you see, I had to do that because I had to keep that image going. I had to keep it up front. I had to let everybody know I was okay. And I will tell you that at 19 years old, I was not okay. No. I was buying my own liquor at 15, 16 years old, and in Atlanta, you got drive-up liquor stores, and they never ask you for ID. I've never been asked for ID in my life, and I think that's kind of sad, really, you know, because it's a cinch I'm not going to be asked for it now, and I just wish, you know, I just wish one time somebody would say, "Are you old enough?" But it's not going to happen. And I would get my little bottle, and at that time I was still living at home, and go back home, and I'd drink. And the department store I worked at was about a 15-minute ride from home, and I'd stop by the liquor store, and I'd get a 6-pack of PBR Tallboys and a quarter of Canadian Blend, and I'd drink that 6-pack before I got home. And then I'd sneak the bottle in the house, and I'd drink to myself into oblivion. And that's what I wanted, and finally things got rough at home, and there was a big family blow-up, and I left. And I found myself a nice little apartment by myself in a nice area of town, picked a real good location. There was a liquor store and a bar within walking distance, and I settled in. And I always lived alone after I left home. I never wanted a roommate because, you see, there had already been people in my life who said, "Judy, you drink too much. Judy, you have to do something about your drinking." And I didn't want a roommate around telling me I had to do something about my drinking. Nobody, nothing was going to interfere with my drinking. You see, I was one of those alcoholics that, like Clancy was talking about last night, I was so sensitive. I mean, I was just so sensitive, and everything hurt. Everything hurt. The Vietnam War was going on at this point in time. I'm a child of the 60s, and I saw a T-shirt one time, and I think it's so appropriate for the 60s, and it said, "If you remember the 60s, you weren't there." You know, and that's kind of the way it was for us, you know. But I can remember the news coming on and talking about the war, and God, I hated that war. And I could just remember the feeling, and, you know, I felt so bad about the guys that were coming back and the way they were being treated, and I felt so helpless. I just felt so helpless because there was nothing I could do. There was absolutely nothing I could do. And I'd see the race riots, you know, that were going on in the 60s, and I'd see people in our communities in this country getting beat over the head with billy clubs, and my God, I'd go nuts. I'd lose sleep over stuff like that. This is not supposed to go on. People aren't supposed to treat people this way. Why is this happening? You know? And then I'd take a couple of pops off that bottle, and none of it mattered. Absolutely none of it mattered. None of it hurt. None of it hurt. You know? And it all just went away. And everything was peaceful and quiet. You know? And I felt good. I felt good. And a lot of times when I got off of work, I didn't even have to have a drink. If I had that bottle in my hand and I was on my way back to my apartment, I knew I was going to be all right. You know, I just knew it. It was just my security. It was what made me feel right with the world. And that's the way it was for me. I stayed on that job, and I'd get off of my days kind of went like this. I got up. I had to be at work at 9:30. I got up, if I could, around 8:30, but generally I had to run to catch the bus to get to work on time. And I'd get to work, and I'd put in my 8 or 10 hours or whatever the store needed at that particular day put in my 8 or 10 hours and hop that bus and go on the way home. And I always stopped at the liquor store and got my quart for the night and whatever else I may be needing. Whether it was a 6-pack of beer or whatever, I'd get that, and I'd walk down the street about a half a block to my apartment, and I'd start sipping on that bottle. And about 6:30, 7 o'clock at night, I'd get to the point where I felt like I needed to talk to someone. You know, and I'd think about people that I knew, and I knew they were going through some rough times, you know. So I'd call them and help them get their life straightened out. And I'd do that from about 7:30 till about 10:30. You know, and then people quit answering the phone, particularly if you've called them 5 or 6 times that evening. They just quit talking. They don't want to talk to you anymore. So they quit answering the phone. And then I'd get lonely. You know, those lonelies that we get. And so I'd walk up to the corner bar and I'd fall in love. And I did that every night. This is not just once in a while. This is not just once a month. This is not once a week. This is every night. This was my routine. This is the way I lived. And I'd get these guys and I'd walk in and size them up, you know, and take a look at which one was going to be my Prince Charming tonight. And I'd look at them and I'd take... always ended up taking one of them home. And sometimes, you know, they'd stay there all night. And sometimes they'd just stay a couple hours. And sometimes they'd just be there a couple of minutes. You know how that goes? I said that last week when I was in Rochester, strictly by accident, but there were some people there that are here this weekend. A man and a wife. And he came up to me last night and said, Judy, 2 minutes was a good day. 2 minutes was a good day. And then the wife told me, she said, you know, when you said that, about half the guys in the audience just slid in their seats. But I tell you, if that applies to you, gentlemen, you keep coming back because that'll get better, too. But they would. And I'd get up the following morning and I'd look in the mirror and I'd go through that nonsense, you know, that same thing, that argument with yourself. Why are you doing this? You know better than to live like this. You know better than to live like this. Now, even though I was raised in an alcoholic home, I knew right from wrong. You know, my parents were not bad people. My mother was is a wonderful, wonderful woman. I knew right from wrong. I knew how to live. You know, but when you're in active alcoholism, it gets too tough to follow the rules, man. It just gets too tough. And so you start making rules of your own. You know, those that you can live with. And somewhere along the line, everything that I had been taught that was right and wrong just didn't matter. It just didn't matter. And like I say, I'd go out again and I'd fall in love. And it was a routine thing. Just a routine thing. And I was at one of these conferences one time, and the gentleman that spoke before me was standing up here, and he was talking pretty much the same thing I'm telling you now. And he brought up about all the dogs that he slept with. You know. And then it was my turn. And I told him he didn't look so good the morning after either. Yes. Yeah. You know, these guys that come in here and share this, where do they think these alcoholic women ended up? We're sitting right here with you guys. You know, I mean, they wake up, they got no teeth in, their hair's a mess, they look at you and say, I love you, baby. And you're supposed to be just delighted, you know, and you're thinking, oh, God. Yeah. Yeah. Things got worse. I quit that job and I went into a place where I could find a husband. I went into a profession where I knew I could find a husband. I decided I needed to be a cocktail waitress. That is what got me to this program at 23 years old, working that profession. I started off in one of the better restaurants, as a matter of fact, in Atlanta. Of course, you knew I did. And by the time I'd been in that business about a year and a half, I was working some pretty rough places. And I was running with some pretty rough people. And we were doing some pretty rough things. And it was getting harder and harder, you see, because I threw my first punch when I was 14 years old. First time I ever hit anybody that I remember. Now, it may have been before that, but I remember that one. And it was at my stepfather, and he had hit me, and I hit the floor. And I got up, and this miracle occurred. I just said, you know, I don't have to take this anymore. And I held off, and I plowed him one right across the jaw. And it felt good. I really loved it. You know, and I became just as addicted to fighting as I did to drinking. And if any of you are out there who came from that, you know what that feels like. It just kind of wells up inside of you, and you can feel it coming out in your fist, and you know you've got to hit somebody. You just have to, because if you don't, you're going to explode. You're just going to explode, you know? And it's got to be taken care of, and it's got to be taken care of now. And as the drinking progressed, so did this part of my story. You know, I was one of those women who woke up with black eyes and cut lips. I was one of those women who woke up, and when I looked in my apartment, furniture would be upturned and things would be broken and I couldn't remember. And when I staggered to the bathroom in the morning and I'd see what I looked like, you know, and I thank God I hope I lost, because if I didn't, I killed somebody. You know, I was just a mess. I was just a mess, and I didn't know whether I was aching because I was so sick from drinking or whether I was aching because somebody kicked me in the ribs one more time. You know, I just didn't know. I just didn't know. And I'd have to go into hiding for a couple of days. You know, there's some bruises that makeup's just not going to cover. It's just not going to cover. And so you go into hiding, and you drink a little bit until you start to get to the point where you can walk out on the streets again. You know. And so there I was in that mess, working these low bars. You know, places like the Blue Cockatoo. And I'd go to that place. She didn't pay you to work there. You just went in and did the best you could on tips. And that was the kind of place where people got in fights and they break beer bottles and come at one another's throat with those broken beer bottles. You know, it was a rough place. And I just kind of stand there and keep on serving drinks. You know, it was a routine kind of thing for us. You didn't part ways. You just let them have at it. It's just the way it was. I kept that up, and it got to be to the point where I really couldn't show up even to work in the dives anymore. I was sick most of the time. I just couldn't get the body up. And there were things that I'd want to do. I'd want to clean the place up where I was living. And I'd try so hard. I'd get up and I'd strip the sheets off the bed, and God knows how long they'd even been on there. And I'd try and put a new set on, and I just couldn't do it. I just give out. I just wore out. You know, I couldn't even go to the laundromat anymore. I would just take my blue jeans and the bell bottoms and I'd fill up the bathtub, you know, and I'd throw them in there, and I'd throw in a box and a half of Tide or something, you know, and I'd let them sit there a couple of days and soak real good, and then I'd rinse them out, and then I'd throw them over something, and then about a week they'd be dry, you know, and that's how I did my laundry, because that's the best I could do. That's just the best I could do. And that's an awful way to live. That's an awful way to live. And I kept that up, and it finally came, as I say, to where I couldn't put in a 40-hour week. And I was running out of money, and more importantly, I was running out of men. And, you know, I had gotten engaged quite a bit during this period when I left the department store and when I went into work in the bar, and because I figured I needed to get married. And I was engaged to two guys at one time. And that makes for exciting living. One of them worked during the day, and one worked at night, and it liked to have killed me, trying to keep up with all that, you know, because I wanted both of them to think they were the only one, and of course, you know how you are when you drink, you get confused, and I got dates confused, and I had both of them standing at the door on the same day, and needless to say, that was over for both of them, but it really didn't matter, because I had a third one in the wings waiting. You know, so that was fine. But what happens, see, when you drink like I did and you live like I did, is that you run out of people. People just burn out with you. Now, I want to tell you, some of these guys were nice guys. I also want to share with you if I had the opportunity to make amends, and I'm grateful for that. You know, but these guys were nice guys. Some of them wanted to reform me, you know, and clean me up, and they knew that they were going to save me. And it just wasn't going to happen, because both of them, you know, they wanted me to make a choice between them and booze. And if it's a choice between you, baby, and the bottle, you're out of here. Because I'm not gonna choose and kick out the only thing that makes my life worth living. You know, you just lose. And I went ahead and I called a guy I had met in the bar and restaurant business, and this guy's name was Pearl. And I called Pearl and I said, "Pearl, I'm out of men, honey, and I'm out of money, and I need some cash, and I need it fast." And I went to work for Pearl that night as a hooker on the streets of Atlanta, because that's what I had to do. And I will tell you, I didn't care. You see, none of it mattered. It absolutely didn't matter. No. Back then, the work girls wore those white vinyl go-go boots. you know, with the big, big heels. And we wore hot pants. I don't know what they call them now, but they're real short shorts. And mine were green satin. You know, let everybody know how classy I was. And I put those on, and I put on those fishnet hose and that halter. And the hair was long and naturally black then. I tell you something that's great about going gray, you know, and mine happened real fast as it does in my family. But since my hair started turning gray, I've been a blonde. I was never able to be a blonde, and I was a blonde, and for a while I was a redhead, and that was fun, you know. And then one time, this is true, it was an awful day. I went to color my hair, and it came out navy blue. And just like a pair of blue jeans. I mean, it was incredible. And that's one of those days, you know how that goes, ladies. You just sit down and cry because the whole world is against you. And but anyhow, I put that garb on and I'd go in and out of those Atlanta hotels and do what I was supposed to do, and I looked like what I was, and I talked like what I was, and it just didn't matter. None of it mattered, and whenever I started thinking about the way I was living, you know, it just didn't matter because all I had to do was take another drink. It just didn't matter. But I was falling apart, you see. Mentally and physically, I was falling apart. And even in that profession, folks, you've got to be able to walk, and I could not handle that. It was getting too much. It was just getting too much. And I was having to duck the law all the time because, as I said, I was running with some folks that were always into stuff they shouldn't have been into. You know, I got on a drunk one weekend and we went to Mexico, and I wasn't aware of the fact till 2 weeks later what we were going to Mexico for, and they stashed everything at my house. And I became acutely aware of what we went to Mexico for, and that was bad because, you see, the GBI was watching me and watching a group of us. We were not nice people, and we were doing things that were against the law. And I don't know, the GBI, by the way, is Georgia Bureau of Investigation. They're one step lower than the FBI, and those guys are not nice people. I mean, they will come through your door and not even knock. They're nasty people, and have absolutely no manners whatsoever. So I was being watched, and I was paranoid, and I had a right to be. Things started getting rough, and of course I did what a lot of alcoholics did. I called Mama, and I said, Mama, I got to get some help, and I checked into a state hospital. Part of the reason why I am sober and have been sober as long as I have is because I have vivid memories of that hospital. Vivid. You know, I went in and I thought that they would let me come by, you know, for maybe an hour a day. I'd been to Shrink's before. That's usually what they scheduled for, is an hour. And so I thought, well, that's what I'll do. I'll go there and they'll let me stay for an hour a day, and maybe I can collect a disability check or something, you know, and get my life together where I can go back out and drink like I want to. And I went in, and they set you in the middle of this room, and seven professional psychiatrists analyze you. Which is wonderful when you're coming off a drink, you're violent, and you're paranoid. That really sets up a real good feeling for you. And they talked to me, and they asked me all these questions, and I gave them the answers I thought they wanted. And so I'm ready for my analysis to come back, you know, when I have to come by for my appointment every day. And they said, no, it's not going to be every day for you. You're going to live here. They put me on a locked ward. They told my family that I was suicidal, homicidal. They told them that they needed to put me away and keep me off the streets because I was of danger to myself and to society. And I don't know how that happened. That's frightening. That is frightening. Because I was violent, they put me on a lot of pills to keep me from hitting the other patients. And you know, there's not a whole lot that goes on when you're on those things. You see the walls breathe, and you just kind of follow the other patients, and you walk around in a circle around the nurse's station because there really isn't that much more to do. And if anybody gets up and starts shuffling over somewhere, you get up and start shuffling right behind them, you know. The highlight of your day is the med line, you know. And I always get so tickled. Every time I think, this is a stupid line of inquiry. You're in a mental hospital, you've got a headache. The counselor comes up and says, why do you have a headache? That's a stupid question. Why are you asking a patient why she has a headache? You know, because they won't give it to you unless you can give, they will not give you aspirin unless you can explain to them why you have a headache. I said, it's idiotic. Things like that used to upset me. I used to have to hit people when they asked me stupid questions like that. But at any rate, I got into it with one of the patients one time, and they put me on restriction, and they told me I couldn't go home on the weekends. And when I was a real good patient, I got to go home on the weekends and spend the time with Mommy. And I didn't spend any time with Mommy. You know that, and I know that. I had no intentions of spending time with Mommy. And I went out, and I got drunk. That's what I did. And I did it every weekend. And but this particular time, I was a bad patient. And they wouldn't let me go. And they said, you're not getting any better, and you're not trying. Well, I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to work my way out of this thing. You know that. You know how we are. And I started, without a doubt, the best con I'd ever run in my life. It was the best con job. You see, because for 3 weeks in that institution, I did everything they wanted me to do. I talked to all the counselors. I told them some stories that, to this day, just gross me out. But they loved it. You know how they are that way. And, you know, it was just, whoa, we got a sicko here. And I would tell them all this stuff. You know, and I was talking to counselors, and I was interacting with other patients, and I was going to decoupage, and I was doing all the stuff they want you to do, and I did that for 3 weeks strong. You know, and then I went to my shrink, and I became humble. And we can become humble when we want something. And I was very humble, and I said, you know, I knew I hadn't been a good patient, and I really hadn't put forth much of an effort, but the past 3 weeks I'd really been trying. And the seasons were changing, and could I please have a 3-hour pass to go pick up my winter clothes? Well, you know, shrinks get so pleased when they think you're getting better. They get that look in their eye that I have cured this one. You know, so he very graciously gave me that 3-hour pass. Now, that was in 1972, and I'm still out on that 3-hour pass. Yeah. Yeah. I had a man waiting for me at the gate, and he had... two cases of Miller High Life. God, I loved that stuff. Miller High Life and 2 quarts of Black Velvet Canadian Blend, and we took off. And somewhere 10 to 14 days later, I was to wake up in a flea bag hotel one more time. And I wasn't quite sure where I was, and I certainly was not sure who I had been with. It was obvious to me and to anyone else that I had not let anyone in to clean up that room. And to the best of my knowledge, I had not bathed. And I was sick. I was really sick. Some kind soul came by and got me, and she took me back to my mother's home. And my mother was to come home that day to find her 23-year-old firstborn daughter. 10 to 14 days without a bath. Stinking from booze and sleeping with men. And that's what she walked in on. And I think to this day, my God, what did that do to her? You know, I was drunk and I knew how I looked. What did that do to her? 2 days later, I attempted suicide. It was no big deal. It was just no big deal. I didn't write a note. I didn't do anything. I went in. I tipped up a bottle of pills I knew would get the job done. Okay, because there was no sense in it. You see, I'd reached the stage now in my alcoholism where I could not get drunk and I couldn't get sober. It was just wake up and take a drink and pass out, and wake up and take a drink and pass out. And there was no more fun, and there was no more excitement, and there was nothing. There was just absolutely nothing. It was just a hole in here, nothing. You know? And there was just no need in it anymore. I mean, I just couldn't beat this thing, man. I just couldn't beat it. So it's just time for me to check out. Just time for me to check out. And yeah, it's going to hurt the family, yeah, but you know, really deep down inside, they'd be glad to be rid of me. You know, because I'd been nothing but trouble. I was always in trouble. I was always fighting. I was always something going on. Always. And I tipped up that bottle of pills, and I sat down in that chair, and I just waited to die. And I could feel them take effect, you know, and I knew, yeah, man, I'm checking out. Finally. Checking out. And my baby sister got up. This is divine intervention. It absolutely has to be. Because my baby sister got up, and she took one look at me, and she went running back to my mother's bedroom. This was very late at night. And she said, you got to get Judy to the hospital. There's something wrong. Now, that child had seen me drunk more than she'd seen me sober. Why she knew it wasn't just Judy passing out again had to be a divine intervention, you know. And they got me to the hospital, and after the hospital got through doing what they do to you when you tip up a bottle of pills, little shrink came in, another one. And he tells me that what I need to do now is go to group therapy. And I sat there with all the arrogance I could muster, and I told him what he could do with his group and his therapy. And I got up and I walked out. He called my mother aside and said, you need to have her committed. The woman wants no help, and she'll never get any better. She's dangerous, and you need to put her away and save you and the rest of the family a lot of grief. And once again, my mother had to stand there and say, what am I going to do with this girl? 3 days later, she did the kindest thing for me she'd ever done. She threw me out. Long and short, there was a big argument, of course, and I don't need to go into that, but what it was that she told me that my behavior was no longer acceptable and I was no longer welcome in her home, to pack my bags and get out, and don't ever come back. Don't ever come back. And I was so bitter to her, and I was so mean, and I was so cruel. And I never hit my mother, and have not to this day, but I remember how I hated her, how cruel she was. You know, and I can still remember the look on her face as I walked out that kitchen door. I can still remember that look, and I hope to God I'll never forget that look. Because it was a mixture of just complete and total pain, you know, and complete and total disgust. She had just had it. And I went to stay with the last person in the world that would have me, and that was my cousin Joanne. And I could talk to you a lot about Joanne because, God, she tried. But the long and the short of that was, I was with her 3 weeks, and she said, you got to pack your bags and go, woman. I've never seen anybody drink like you. And out the door I was. And I was standing there, and it was December the 18th. And I was standing there looking out that door. And that this is the moment, you know, that God touches every alcoholic. And this was my moment. Because all of a sudden, you see, it was nobody else's fault. All of a sudden, I had that clarity that said, it's you, kid. The jig is up, and it's you. You know, you've got to do something. And in my stupor, I turned to Joe, and I said, would you call AA? And I'd seen a little bit about Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was in the mental hospital, one of the patients suggested that I go to that, because I talk a lot about drinking. And I will tell you, that is the only person in the 6 months that I lived at that place that ever suggested to me I do something about my drinking was another nut on the ward with me. Okay? None of the counselors ever did. No. Uh-uh. It took another patient to say, Judy, you got a problem with your drinking. Because everybody wanted to blame it on somebody else. Everybody, I love what Clancy said last night. You know, I blamed everybody for the situation I was in prior to getting to Alcoholics Anonymous. I will not do that here. If they taught me nothing else when I got here, they taught me you are responsible. You know, despite the fact that what I lived as a child was not a good childhood, no one in that family ever forced me to take a drink. That was my decision. I tipped that bottle up. I sought that relief. Okay, that's the way I dealt with it. Now, I have two sisters that were raised in that home. I'm grateful to God neither of them were sexually abused, okay? But neither one of them drink. Neither one of them have used drugs ever. I chose to, you know. Now, I'll be honest with you, I have one sister. I think it would help her personality if she'd get bombed every now and then. She is such a prude. It's incredible. And I love the family get-togethers we have, you know, because periodically I'll say something off color. And my mother just giggles like a little teenager, you know, and my middle sister is sitting there going, oh, my God, I don't believe you said that. And I just lighten up. Yeah. So Joe called Alcoholics Anonymous for me. And I got to tell you about the 12-step call. It's a trip. I started getting ready at 4:30 when she called. The people said they'd be there at 7:15, and they were. And I started getting ready at 4:30. Joanne helped me to bathe. When I called central office, they told me to try not to drink. And she said, can you go to 7 o'clock tonight without a drink? And I said, no, I don't think so. It's a long time. It's a long time. And she told me to eat some honey and make sure I drank something sweet, you know, some kind of soda pop or something. And that's what I lived on the first 3 days I was sober, was Subi honey and Pepsi-Cola. That's all I could handle. But it did keep the shakes down, and they came in the door at 7:15. And the first one to walk in was one of the best-looking men I'd ever laid my eyes on. And I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous right then. Yes, sir. You know, God, he was a good-looking man. And he was so clean, and his hair was combed so well, you know, and he had a beautiful sweater. And oh, geez, he was nice. You know, he's just wonderful. He came in and introduced himself, and of course I tried to smile and be charming, and I never took my cigarette out of my mouth then. I always let it just kind of dangle, you know, and he introduced himself, and it was bobbing up and down as I introduced myself, because I just didn't take a cigarette. See, you had to leave the cigarette in your mouth, and you had to leave the hair hanging down over your eye, because that meant you were a tough little broad, okay? And when you're a tough little broad and you did the kind of things I did, people stayed away from you, and that's exactly what I wanted. Don't get close to me, because I'll hurt you, you know, I'll hurt you. And so he came in and introduced himself, and right behind him, came Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm. She was a pert, cute, sweet little lady. And God, I hated sweet little ladies. And I will never forget this woman as long as I live. I'll never forget what she had on. She had on a brown princess coat, double-breasted, you know, little velvet collar. Her blouse was coming up over the collar, little lace right here. You know, itty-bitty little heels, tiny little ladylike heels, which blew my mind because I'd been wearing 3.5-inch stilettos, and she comes with these little heels. And white gloves. And she walked over to me with the biggest grin I'd ever seen, and she said, "Hi, my name's Bunny." And I thought, ooh. Oh, God, and I felt like looking at him and saying, "Couldn't you have left her outside or something, man?" And they sat down and they talked to me a little bit about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't hear a whole lot. And my only question to them while I was there in the apartment is, okay, what's this thing going to cost me? You know, when I was working for Pearl, we didn't have group insurance, so, you know, it was a consideration I had to look at. And I remember Buddy saying that, it's not going to cost you anything. He said, "The only thing that we ask is that when you get sober, you do what we're doing tonight. That's all it's going to cost you." And, of course, I lied, and I said, "Oh, yeah, I can do that." I had no intentions of doing that, ever. I know, but I figured if it'll get me out. And we went to our first meeting, and, my God, it was in a church, and that scared me. Now, because my Polish grandmother used to say about sinners, if they ever go back to church, the roof's going to cave in. You know, and I was not feeling well, and I kept checking those beams and thinking, "Oh, God, I hope she was wrong." You know, because I knew I was a sinner, and I knew that I had no business in a church. And I was frightened, as most of us were. And they gave me a half a cup of coffee. And the meeting began, and I remember, as most of you do, the laughter. The laughter of Alcoholics Anonymous. The music of Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay? Because that is the sole music of Alcoholics Anonymous, is our laughter. And I remember that. And I remember the love in which they talked to one another. And the caring. And I don't know why it was, I knew it was real, but I knew it was real. You know, and I didn't say much that first meeting. And at the end of the meeting, it came around, and they were getting ready to close. And Buddy asked me, he said, "Judy, is there anything you want to know about us? Do you have any questions?" And I remember saying, and it absolutely blows my mind, I don't know where this came from. I remember saying, "No. No, I just don't want to drink anymore. I am sick to death of being drunk." And Buddy reached across the table and he patted my hand. And he said, "You don't ever have to drink again." Now, why I believed him, I have no idea. But I knew he was telling me truth. I knew that. You know. And, of course, this group I went to, as you would expect, was on the best side of town. Was on the decent side of town. And they told me I had to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and I didn't have a whole lot else to do, so that wasn't a big problem. You know, and I was going to meetings there, but I was even new, less than 2 weeks sobriety. I knew I was different from these ladies. I knew I was different. I knew I talked different. I knew I walked different. I knew I acted different. You know, I knew that I talked to men differently than they did. And these women would come in, and they'd be talking in a meeting about going to a PTA meeting drunk. You know, and my thought was, how else would you go to one of those things? You know? It makes no sense to me to walk into something like that stone cold sober. You know, but they would talk about this, and none of that registered. None of that registered with me. And I began to feel myself pulling away. You see, and it was not the women in the group. Understand, it was not the women in that group. It was me, because they were ladies. They were ladies, and I could never measure up to them. And if they knew where I had been and what I had done and how I had lived, they'd want nothing to do with me. And I couldn't get close to them, and I couldn't talk to them, because they may reject me. You see, they're not going to like my mouth. They're not going to like the way I dress. And I knew that. And some woman had the sensitivity enough to see that. And she came up to me and she said, there's a group over in Chamblee that I think you'd enjoy. You know? And I went over there and I was so grateful, because there were people there just like me. There were street drunks there. There were people who had been out there fighting a war, man, on a daily basis. You know, and they knew where I was coming from. They knew how desperately it was, how desperate I was to live. But they knew I couldn't let you know. I couldn't let you know. I was dying inside, and I didn't know how to cope with living. I just didn't know. I didn't know how to drop this tough facade. I just didn't know. And they understood that. And they were loving, and I was going to say they were kind. They were not kind. Okay, they weren't kind, but they were loving, you know, but they were tough. And I am grateful for that. It is my feeling as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, my sobriety date is December the 18th, 1972. That is the day I had them. Thank you. I don't mind you applauding, because as far as I'm concerned, you're applauding for Alcoholics Anonymous. You're not applauding for me. Okay? You know, AA works. AA works. And I got in there, and I was so frightened. I was just so frightened. And there were two guys there, wonderful, wonderful men. And they took me under their wing. And one was Big Jim, and one was Dad. We called him Dad. And for some reason, these guys took me under their wing. And Big Jim had 12 years, and Dad had 8. You know? And I still didn't want to talk to women, because I knew I couldn't measure up. But I knew how to talk to guys, and I knew how to get along with guys, and I was more comfortable with men. You know, I want to share with you all, and particularly the men, that if you see a little gal coming into your home group and she's got blue jeans on that you know took a pair of pliers to help her get them on, you know, and she walks in there and she's scared half to death of women, you remember, please, there are 12 steps to Alcoholics Anonymous, not 13. Okay? 12. Because those two men took me under their wing, and they wanted nothing for me or nothing from me but for me to get sober. That's all they wanted, you know. And they started teaching me how to live. They didn't preach to me out of the big book. They didn't stand here and say, read your book. They taught me what they did to live Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's real easy, particularly if you aren't living this program, to say, just read your big book, when somebody's sitting over in the corner dying. You know, it's real easy to be that glib about it. You know, it's a cop-out. You know, you're living the big book, it's a different story, because you can feel that individual's pain that's sitting over there in the corner, and you can pull them aside and say, let me tell you what I did, baby, when I was right where you're at, when I was feeling right what you're feeling. Let me tell you what I did. You see, and that's what Big Jim and Dad did for me. That's what they did for me. I remember I came into the room one day, I was about 3 months sober, and I was very angry at a woman who was back in the back of the room, and Dad spotted it. And he knew anger, you know. Dad was a tiny man, just a little bantyweight man. And now he was an ex-merchant marine, and he was meaner than a snake. He's a mean man. And he saw me come flying in that room, and he said, Judy. And I turned around, and I said, what? He said, where are you going? I said, you see that broad back there? I've had it with her, man. I'm taking her outside. I've had it with her mouth. She's always running that mouth. I've had it. We're going to settle this right now. Dad said, get you a cup of coffee and sit down. That is not suggestions, okay? And I could tell by the way Dad said it, this was not open for discussion. And I went and I got a cup of coffee and I sat down, and I was still just seething mad. And Dad looked at me and took that little finger. He was so good with that finger. And he'd poke you right in the chest and he'd say, if you're going to stay sober, you got to quit hitting people. Hitting people is not socially acceptable behavior. And I'm sitting there rum-dum, you know, isn't this me, man? Because the people I ran with, that's the way you solve things. You know, if you disagree with somebody, you just hit them. You didn't talk about it. You know, you didn't think, is this in good taste? You didn't think about things like that. You just didn't do that. And then Dad gave me a gift that I give to you. He said to me, Judy, you cannot live like a drunk and expect sobriety. No. You've got to change, baby. And that hit, because above everything else, I wanted not to drink. I wanted not to drink. Please, dear God, I don't want to drink. Well, yeah. And I did not hit that woman that day. I cussed her out, but I didn't hit her. You see? And that was growth. That was growth. For me, that was growth. And time went on, and I wasn't sober very long. Shortly after Dad and I had this talk. And time went on, and I decided I needed to get married. Because every decent lady I'd ever known was married. And that's what I needed to do. That's newcomer thinking. And so I thought about an Alcoholics Anonymous looking for a husband. That's not hard to do here. Okay? It doesn't take long. At 4 months, I was married. My spouse had 5 months. Now, the deacons in my group just sat back and waited for it to happen. Jim was such a help to me. He did everything he could to help me through that situation. And it was, we were there for about another 6 months. And I went through a lot in those 6 months. I went through a lot of learning how to grow up. I went to those 90 meetings in 90 days like they told me, and I kept on going. And I went to a meeting every night, you know. And I did that out of fear. I did that out of fear. There was something I had here, and I was afraid if I didn't show up, I'd lose it. You know, so I just kept coming to meetings. I just kept coming to meetings, and I was the kind of newcomer that if I disagreed with what somebody said in the meeting, I'd stand up and cuss them out. I'd tell them what I thought, you know. And then Dad would sit there and say, sit down and shut up. You know, that's the way they were. And I'd sit down, and I didn't like it. And I don't know why I did it. I just did it because Dad or Jim said to do it. You know, and Jim was the kind that taught you how to act, you know, when you went out. And he'd force you to get involved. And he'd say, we're going to dinner, Judy. You want to come with us? And he knew I was broke. I didn't have any money. He'd say, I'll pick it up. Come on with us. And I'd go, and I'd always sit, and I was very, very quiet. I never participated in the conversation. And Jim would force me to participate in the conversation. You know, he'd say, what do you think about it, Judy? How do you feel about it? He forced me to interact. When my mouth got too bad and I was embarrassing the people I was sitting with, he'd give me that look that only a dedicated sponsor can give you. You know, and I knew I was off track. I saw Big Jim one time. A bunch of us went out to eat, and one of the guys that was a newcomer and a Mr. Executive got up, and he didn't leave a tip on the table for the waitress. And Jim waited till he got clear across the restaurant and ready to check out. And he walked up to him, and he said, you don't think that girl deserves to get paid? And the junior executive standing there. Well, I didn't really think about it. And Jim said, it's about time you start thinking about it. You get back there and leave her a tip. And the whole restaurant's looking at this guy. And, but Jim had a way of doing that. When he said, you go do it, you by God better go do it. And so the guy kind of hung his head and walked back and laid a buck on the table. You know, Jim taught us how to live. He taught us what was socially acceptable. Let me tell you something that was great about Big Jim. Big Jim was a truck driver with a fourth grade education. I learned more about living from that man than I've ever learned from anybody. And I learned more about loving people from that man than I ever learned from anybody. You know, at 9 months sobriety, my husband and I decided what we needed to do was move to the country. Now, I have been asphalt and concrete all my life. I know absolutely nothing about country living. Nothing. And I go move up to a small town in the North Georgia Mountains, Hiawassee, Georgia. And that is strong Southern Baptist, foot-washing Baptist, and Church of God folks up there. And I made the mistake walking in there and telling them I was a Catholic. They don't like Catholics up there. I told them I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 9 months sober, and my mouth was atrocious, and I was using words those people had never heard. And I was getting some strange looks, and of course, since I was always broke, I hadn't worn, I didn't go out and buy new clothes, so I walked the streets of that Georgia town in the same thing I walked Peachtree and 10th on, you know, and people would stare at me, you know. And I just didn't fit in, and God knows I tried, but I just didn't know how to fit in. And meetings were far away up there. They were like 30 and 60 miles away from our home. And I'll tell you, when you've got $2 in your pocket, you don't know whether to give the $2 for gas to go to a meeting or whether you're going to eat that night. And see, that's the way it was for me in early sobriety. We were just broke. There was no place to work up there. Absolutely no jobs at all. We didn't check any of this out, you know. We didn't look at how are we going to pay for all. Didn't look at any of that. And I swear to you, if it hadn't been for a deer that my husband shot that winter, I don't know what we'd have eaten. No, those are rough times, and I'm grateful for them. Grateful for them. And I can cook a mean venison steak, I'll tell you. It is some kind of good. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for that experience. I'm one of those people that you believe that you can stay sober, regardless of what your conditions are. You know, you just trust God and clean house. And trust God and clean house. And we got up there, and it was bad. The marriage was not good, obviously, and of course it's not good. We didn't know what we wanted. We didn't know what we wanted in a relationship. We just got married because it seemed like the thing to do at the time. And there was a lot of battling, a lot of fighting, and my ex-husband had a hard time staying sober. And I was alone most of the time. And I can remember just absolutely being heartbroken, and for the first time in my many, many years, I felt pain. I felt pain, and I didn't know how to deal with pain. And North Georgia Mountains is moonshine country. And if you've ever drunk any of that stuff, you know that stuff will set you free in no time at all. And I knew where everybody in the mountains knows where you can get it, and we had... And I was thinking seriously about making some calls and sending somebody to run get some shine, and I was crying, and I took my two dogs. And we went for a walk, and close to my home was a beautiful little 8-acre lake, and behind that lake was a beautiful mountain. And my God, it's a glorious sight, just a glorious sight. And those two dogs and I went down there, and we sat next to this little lake on this grassy knoll, and I remember looking up at that mountain, and I remember saying, God, I don't know if you're up there. And I don't know if you can hear me, but I got to have some relief or I'll drink again. And I don't want to drink again. I don't want to drink again. Now, what happened was the air became very still and very quiet and very warm. And there was a presence of someone or something next to me, much like a good friend, who patted me on the shoulder and said, "You're going to be okay, kid. You're going to be okay." And when I got up from that grassy knoll and I started walking back to that house, I must share with you that for the first time in my life, I was a child of God. For the very first time. I had never known that. I had never known that. But that day, I knew it, and I've known it ever since. You know, and just on that qualification alone, I deserved the right to be happy. That's all I needed. You know, that day, all of a sudden, I wasn't a little piece of trash anymore. You know, I was one of those women that heard over and over and over again in her drinking career, "You're nothing but trash, and you're never going to be anything but trash, and get out of my life." You know, but that day, none of that mattered. I had heard in my drinking career, "You stay away from my children. My children are not to see a woman like you." And that day, it didn't matter. It didn't matter. It didn't hurt anymore. You know, it didn't hurt anymore. And I remember the words of my mom going over and over, "You get out and don't you come back. You're no longer welcome here." You know, and that day I knew something was going to be okay there. Something was going to be okay. And as time progressed and as things got worse, I came back to Atlanta and I filed for divorce. And I'm about 2.5 years sober now. And I'm still not doing real well job-wise. Took a job as a waitress, and that's fine. I know that's what I had to do because I just couldn't do much of anything else. And I went to work for a temporary agency, and I worked on different jobs. And a temporary agency is wonderful if you have the personality that I have. You know, because I could go in and I could work a job for a week or so, and about the time people were starting to tick me off, they moved me. I went to another job. And it worked, and I did that for 2 years. It was great. Because, you see, I still had problems with personalities. Now, I'm going to tell you, if you're sitting in that audience now, if you're sitting in the audience now, and you have between 2.5 and 4 years sobriety, and you're thinking about leaving this meeting and going home and blowing your brains out, you are okay. As a matter of fact, you're right on schedule. Okay? There is somewhere between that line where all of a sudden we realize this is reality. This is life, you know, and for most of us, it's real painful, okay? All pain does is it hurts. It won't kill you, you know, but what you are not giving yourself credit for, if you're one of those, what you are not giving yourself credit for is Alcoholics Anonymous has you, darling, because you ain't thinking about drinking, okay? And for the alcoholic, that's what's crucial. And if you don't have a sponsor, you get a sponsor and you sit down and talk to them about what's going on in your life and why you feel like it's not worth it anymore. Alcoholics Anonymous gives you hope. And if you're not feeling the hope that it's going to get better, you need to talk to someone because it will get better. You know, you will get better. You know. So you get somebody and you talk to them. And don't pay attention to those who say, well, if you just read your big book. No. No, that's not an answer. We got an alcoholic here who's dying. Don't come up to me with a flippant, just read your big book. Sit down, take 15 minutes out of your busy schedule and talk to that drunk. No. Talk to him. Share with him. I know what it's like to want to blow your brains out. I know what it's like to walk into a meeting and everybody's happy. You know, and then you got the Rebeccas, right, who come up and say, isn't sobriety wonderful? And I go, get out of my face. You know, because sobriety isn't wonderful for a lot of us. Sobriety is just tough. It's just plain tough. It is stark reality against raw nerves, and it's painful. You know, and I'm 2.5 years sober and nothing's going right. Where are all these things that y'all talk about? You know, I'm supposed to have. I can't hold a job. I just had a marriage blow up in my face. And you keep telling me to come back? For what? You know? And I sat down and I started talking to Big Jim. And I started telling him about the way I was feeling. You know? And he said, Judy, what are you grateful for? He said, every day from now on, you are to find one thing. And I don't care if it takes you 3 hours. You find one thing you're grateful for. And sometimes it was real basic stuff. Because I'll tell you, I was not one of those who could say, I'm real grateful I'm not drinking today. There were some days I wanted to drink. I wanted a drink. Because I wanted out, man. I wanted to check out. You know, and I knew that'd get it done. You know, but I'd have to look for something to be grateful for. And I drove by one day, and there was a cop car on the side of the road. And there was a woman sitting on the grass next to the road. And she was just kind of slouched there. And she had emptied out her bag trying to help the police officer find her driver's license. You know, and she was a mess. She was a mess. And her clothes were dirty and her hair was dirty. And she was just a mess. And I had something that day to be grateful for. I was grateful that wasn't me. I was grateful I had a chance of not having to live like that anymore. You know, I met my husband Craig in 73. And, we had been friends for many years, and we had parted ways because of the move and whatnot. And at any rate, we got back together, and unbeknownst to him or myself, we both gotten a divorce, and we started talking again. And we got married in 76, and Craig and I are still together. And I'll tell you one thing about an alcoholic marriage: if you're not in one and you're thinking about one, it will not be easy. Okay, but it will never be dull. Never. No. It's just exciting. Craig and I never know what we're going to get ourselves into next. We just don't know. You know. And Big Jim helped. As a matter of fact, Big Jim was our best man at our wedding. And we had an AA wedding. And we had a wedding in a church, you know. Isn't that incredible, a wedding in a church? It was wonderful, you know. And all our AA friends were there, and it was great. And we've had some rough times, and Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't guarantee me that I'm not going to have rough times. It doesn't guarantee me that. And I'm going to share with you some of those rough times. You see, after 10 years sobriety, my husband Craig chose to drink again. And I'm going to tell you that was painful. I am going to tell you, too, I do not make a good Al-Anon. I am not a good Al-Anon. I don't release with love. I release with a lot of pain, and preferably I'm the alcoholic. And, you know, I just don't do that well. I want to share with you, too, that Al-Anons are very, very important to me. Because, you see, when my husband, Craig, drank, those women came to me. I didn't go to them. They came to me. They knew what was going on in my life. They told me what they did. They shared with me that I was feeling okay, you know, because I was baffled by this stuff. You know, I can't wait for him to get home so I can kill him. You know, God, I hope he gets here alive so I can beat him up. You know, and I didn't understand those feelings. And I went to the Al-Anons, and my God, they were so loving to me. And they told me, you know, don't make a decision now. Don't make a decision now about what you're going to do with your marriage. Because Craig had, we had made a pact when we got together that if either one of us chose to drink again, that we would leave the house. And he did. And I didn't know where he was, and he was very, very sick. My husband Craig was very, very sick. He had some back problems, and the truth of the matter was there was about a 50-50 chance he'd ever walk again. And he was diabetic, and I knew he was holed up in a hotel somewhere, popping that bottle, and I didn't know if he was going to live. And I went to the Al-Anons and told him, you know, I'm supposed to be in Columbus, Ohio this weekend. I don't know where he is. I don't know whether I should go or not. And the Al-Anon group, you know, told me, you know, he's going to stay drunk whether you're in Atlanta or Columbus, so why don't you go and have a good time? So I did. I thought, sounded good to me, you know. And when I got back, he was still drunk, didn't change a thing. I had one heck of a good weekend. And I was real grateful. I was real grateful for their kindness and for their sharing. And they mean much to me. Alcoholics Anonymous is a very, very dear program to me. I have been through problems in sobriety that I didn't think you were supposed to have. I've had financial problems that were very, very serious. And, you know, you don't have to drink over it. And bottom line is you got a roof over your head and you got a full pantry and a car that'll run. Even if you do have to jump it off every now and then, you're all right. You're all right. There's not that much more. Our priorities do change. Our priorities do change. Craig and I bought a farmhouse recently in Ohio. We moved out of Atlanta, and we got an old 100-year-old farmhouse. And I am so looking forward to that, you know. I don't know what we're going to do. Neither one of us are employed. You talk about miracles in AA, neither one of us are employed, and we just bought a house, eh? You know, we had to come up with a pretty good downstroke to keep them happy, but, you know, it works, and it's just a miracle. Everybody in Atlanta told us it'll take us a year to sell the house. We sold the house in 2 weeks. And the guy said, by the way, I got to be in. I sold it to him on, I think we got the contract together the 13th of August, and he said, by the way, I got to be in here September the 4th. And I said, you're kidding. And he said, no. He said, I've already leased my house, so I have to be in here the 4th of September. And so we got packed up, moved out, and stayed with Craig's brother in Ohio. And then that was glorious because it was just one big happy family. And we got along so well. I know. I've had some concerns, and I'm going to share those briefly with you, and about what's going on in Alcoholics Anonymous. And just a little bit of concern. You know, because I know that Alcoholics Anonymous, the head honcho here is God. Please don't ever forget that. But as I go along and do this kind of thing on a regular basis, I begin to hear things that make me uncomfortable. I begin to hear that people in Alcoholics Anonymous object to the foul language of the new ones coming in. You know? And so they are taking their groups or their select few, and they're taking these groups into their homes. And they're having AA meetings in their homes because they find the language offensive. Now, let me tell you what a guy in my group did because he found my language offensive. He came up to me and he said, Judy, why do you cuss so much? No. He told me that was not socially acceptable. Now, I did not do with cussing like I did with drinking. Okay, I tapered off of cussing. But the first thing I did was I stopped using the Lord's name in vain. But you see, my point here is, don't decide that you need to pull out and form your own elite group because cussing offends you. Go to that new one and say, your cussing offends me. Why don't you try cleaning up your mouth? You know? I hear now that there are people who are taking these groups into their home, and you have to come in by invitation only. All right? And that some of these groups are taking their collections and they're buying china to serve the donuts and coffee in. Isn't that precious? You know, I was talking about cleaning up earlier. My wish for all of you, please, is that you never clean up in Alcoholics Anonymous so well you forget what it's like to feel dirty. Don't do that to yourself. Okay? Don't do that. That is not what this program is based on. Now, I am a big believer in traditions. I've got a real problem with violations of traditions. I got thrown out of a club room that I met in for the bulk of my sobriety because there was a violation of traditions, and I said, and I quoted from the 12 and 12, you cannot tell that man he can't come back here. And so they threw me and my group out. And that's fine, because you know what we did. We got a coffee pot and we started another group. That's what we did. And we rented a little place, and we put that together, and we got the people that had been attending that group for a long time, and I want you to know that group is the Night Owls group in Atlanta. And that Night Owls group has 23 meetings a week going now. You know? And everybody in AA knows if you've got one that is really a mess, send them to Night Owls. You know, they'll straighten them out. You know, and then they can come back to the socially acceptable meetings. Let me read to you just real quick out of what it says in Tradition 3. If you haven't studied your traditions, please give yourself a treat and study them. There's a lot in there about the way we were in the early years and how we decided to be what we were going to be and how we were going to be that. And what it says in Tradition 3, and they're talking about how they were going to discern who belongs to Alcoholics Anonymous and who can get in. And this is a paragraph from that conversation they were having. We were resolved to admit nobody to AA, but that hypothetical class of people we termed pure alcoholics. Except for their guzzling and the unfortunate results thereof, they could have no other complications. So beggars, tramps, asylum inmates, prisoners, queers, plain crackpots, and fallen women were definitely out. Yes, sir, we'd cater only to the pure and respectable alcoholic. Any others would surely destroy us. Besides, if we took in those odd ones, what would decent people say about us? We built a fine mesh right around AA. Now, I don't know how you all feel, but I am very grateful that they decided not to leave that as the rules. You see, because I could not have been here. And the truth of the matter is, there would be no home group for me in Atlanta, because that's all my group is made up of. You know, that is it. That's it. And we forget that. The other thing I want to touch on, too, is that I hear a lot, because I do love the program, I hear a lot from our central office, and I hear a lot from central offices throughout the country, that they can't keep their doors open, okay, that they're running in debt more and more. Now, for those of you who didn't come to us off the streets, let me explain to you what happens to that buck you put in the basket. All right? That helps to pay for the coffee. That helps to pay for the literature for the new drunk who can't afford it. That dollar helps to keep that central office open so that when somebody like me who couldn't afford a detox center needs help, there is someone there to answer the phone. That's what that dollar does. Okay? There is someone to keep our general service office in New York. It keeps that going. Okay? It is not a matter of convenience. It is the lifeblood of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not putting a pitch up here for money. That's not what I'm doing. I just want you to understand that that dollar does more than just pay the rent and pay for coffee. You know? That dollar saves lives. All right? And I know as well as anyone in here how tough it is right now. Believe me, it's been real rough for us the past 3 years since Craig's illness. It's been very, very rough. But we've got to do this for the newcomer. You see, God forbid that they call a central office and find out the phone's been disconnected because we can't pay the bill. Okay? And if you belong to a group and you don't know where that money is going, you get with the treasurer and find out. And find out if your group is carrying its weight. You know, it's a tragedy to me that there are 75 groups in Atlanta. 75 groups, okay, and only 4 of them make regular contributions to our central office. Okay, that is sad. There is no excuse for that. There is no excuse for that. You know, even if the contribution is less, my God, kick in something. Kick in something. Because that new drunk isn't going to have the money to buy that big book. That new drunk isn't going to have the 35 cents for a pamphlet, you know, that he may need to read. No, so find out where it's going. You've got that right. You're a member of that group. Don't let anybody tell you that's none of your business. It is your business, sweetie. It is your business, and you've got that right. No, because we have to be there for the next ones. No, and if you're sponsoring someone, please don't confuse sponsorship with being a counselor. All right? That is not where it comes from in Alcoholics Anonymous. The glory of this program is that I can sit down with another drunk, look her dead in the eye, and say, I know just how you feel, baby. All right? Nobody, I don't care how much you've studied out of a book, nobody but another alcoholic can do that. Okay? Nobody. You know, and when you look at these girls or the men, and I'm not a big believer for obvious reasons that men have to sponsor men and women have to sponsor women. I know sometimes that's not safe, but keep your priorities in mind, okay? But when you look at these people and you start sharing, you know, share from the heart. Don't worry about how you appear to them. These people are hurting. The newcomer is hurting. And don't worry about hurting their feelings, okay? I am more concerned with the girls that I sponsor, that I can say something that will keep them alive one more day than I am about hurting their delicate little feelings. Okay, I'm not worried about your feelings. I'm worried about your life, sweetheart. I want you to live. I want you to know that sobriety can be joyous, that you can be free no matter what the situation is. And this is how I did it, you know. And I have seen miracles. I have seen miracles. I saw a little girl come into this program, and she wouldn't talk to anybody but Craig and myself. And 5 years later, that girl's standing on a stage at a roundup in Atlanta singing her heart out. And I sat there like a baby and just bawled because I got to be a part of that. I got to be a part of that woman learning how to live, you know, and I was so proud of her. I was so proud of her. I have watched women come into this program who weren't allowed to see their children. And I've gotten the phone call that said, Jude, they're going to let me have my kids back for a weekend. I'm going to be able to see my kids. And I thank God I was allowed to be a part of that. I was allowed to be a part of that. You know, the healing, the getting better. I am so grateful that I know how to have fun. We had a picnic at Night Owls. We had a family picnic. Everybody comes. You don't have to be a drunk. You can bring your mama. You can bring anybody you want. We had aunts and grandmothers and everybody there. But it was kind of slow in starting off. So I went in and I got a big bowl of sour cream. And I got a tablespoon. And I picked the meanest sponsory I had. And I'm sitting there watching her trying to play volleyball. And I took that tablespoon full of sour cream and I just... And she looked at me like, you really didn't do that, did you? So just to guarantee her that I did, I took another one. And... Well, that was it. There was a food fight going. She and I had sour cream all over us. We were a mess. People were dying laughing. You know, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. I wish we hadn't done it in mid-July in Georgia because that sour cream really was uncomfortable later. As a matter of fact, the group said, if you two would step over here, we'd like to hose you down. But it was fun, you know, and it was great. And it got everybody going, and everybody started laughing, you know, because this is Alcoholics Anonymous. See, I was never allowed to do things like that. I couldn't do things like that, and this is fun, you know. This is a glorious, glorious program. And when you take on the responsibility of sponsoring people, transmit that to them. You know, transmit to them that they are decent human beings. Big Jim told me one time, Judy, you just ain't that good at being bad, sweetheart. You just ain't that good at being bad. I took my fifth step with Jim. Jim was the one that told me I would have to learn how to forgive. I would have to try and understand. I share with you that 3 days before my stepfather died, he called me and apologized for what he had done to me as a child. That is absolutely frightening to me because I hadn't talked to him in over a year. And he just happened to call my mother's home, and I was there, and I answered the phone. And he cried on that phone, and he said, I'm sorry for what I did to you. And I said, I'm sorry for what I did to you. And 3 days later, he burned in a fire. You know, incredible. But the forgiveness is there. And because I was to find out how he lived as a kid. And I began to understand my mother, thank you very much, is a wonderful, glorious woman. You know, and we have beautiful times together today. And my mother says something, and she says many things to me that just make me glow all over. You know, but I'll never forget one time I went over to visit her, because we visit a lot now. You know, and I went over to visit her, and she stood at that same kitchen door. And she said, honey, I wish you didn't have to leave. Can't you just stay a little longer? That is Alcoholics Anonymous. That is what you all did for me. I want you to know that since I've been in this fellowship, 3 people have asked me, Judy, if anything happens to me, will you take care of my kids? That doesn't happen to women like me. Women like me aren't requested that honor. Okay, this program works. The job of an AA speaker, as I was once told, is to bring comfort to the disturbed and to disturb the comfortable. And I truly hope that I've done that today. I want to close with... I always close with this paragraph out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I appreciate y'all's attention. I know that I have kept you here for a long time, and you have been wonderful. Actually, I just knew you weren't going anywhere till I finished. I wish I could tell you I was humble, but I'm working on it. But I close with this paragraph because it is, there's many beautiful paragraphs, but this is one of my favorites. If you don't know where it is in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, read the book, please, till you find it. And it says so beautifully, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.